love than in being undeceived by them. François La Rochefoucauld, Maxims. Tess awoke the next day to Sophie lighting the lamp by her bedside. With a moan, Tessa made a move to cover her aching eyes. "Now then, miss," Sophie addressed Tessa with her usual briskness. "You've gone and slept the day away. It's past 8 o'clock in the evening, and Charlotte says to wake you." "Past 8? At night?" Tessa threw back her blankets, only to realize to her surprise that she was still wearing Camille's gown, now crushed and crumpled, not to mention stained. She must have collapsed into bed still entirely dressed. Memories of the night before began to flood into her mind, the white faces of vampires, the fire eating its way up the curtains, Magnus Bane laughing, De Quincey, Nathaniel, and Will. "Oh, God," she thought. "Will." She pushed the thought of him from her mind and sat up, looking anxiously at Sophie. "My brother," she said. "Is he..." Sophie's smile wavered. "No worse, really, but no better either." Seeing Tessa's stricken expression, she said, "A hot bath and food, miss, that's what you need. It won't make your brother any better for you to starve and let yourself get filthy." Tessa looked down at herself. Camille's dress was ruined, that was evident, torn and stained with blood and ash in a dozen places. Her silk stockings were ripped, her feet filthy, her hands and arms streaked with grime. She hesitated to think about the state of her hair. "I suppose you're right." The bathtub was an oval, claw-footed affair, hidden behind a Japanese screen in a corner of the room. Sophie had filled it with hot water that was already beginning to cool. Tessa slid behind the screen, undressed, and lowered herself into the bath. The hot water came up to her shoulders, warming her. For a moment she sat motionless, letting the heat soak into her chilled bones. Slowly she began to relax and closed her eyes. Memories of Will flooded in on her. Will, the attic, the way he had touched her hand, the way he had kissed her, then ordered her away. She ducked under the surface of the water as if she could hide from the humiliating memory. It didn't work. "Drowning yourself won't help," she told herself sternly. "Now drowning will, on the other hand." She sat up, reached for the cake of lavender soap on the edge of the bath, and scrubbed her skin and hair with it until the water turned black with ash and dirt. Perhaps it wasn't actually possible to scrub away your thoughts of someone, but she could try. Sophie was waiting for Tessa when she emerged from behind the screen. There was a tray of sandwiches and tea at the ready. In front of the mirror, she helped Tessa dress in her yellow gown trimmed with dark braid. It was fussier than Tessa would have preferred, but Jessamine had liked the design very much in the shop and had insisted that Tessa have it made for her.
"I can't wear yellow, but it's ever so suitable for girls with dull brown hair like yours," she'd said.
The feeling of the brush going through her hair was very pleasant. It reminded Tessa of when she had been a small girl and Aunt Harriet had brushed her hair for her. It was soothing enough that when Sophie spoke next, it jolted her slightly.
"Did you manage to get Mr. Herondale to take his medicine last night, miss?"
Oh, Tessa scrambled to collect herself, but it was too late. Scarlet color had flooded up her neck into her face. "He didn't want to," she finished lamely, "but I convinced him in the end."
"I see."
Sophie's expression didn't change, but the rhythmic strokes of the brush through Tessa's hair began to come faster.
"I know it's not my place, but..."
"Sophie, you can say anything you want to me, truly."
"It's just... Master Will."
Sophie's words came out in a rush.
"He isn't someone you should care for, Miss Tessa. Not like that. He isn't to be trusted or relied on. He isn't what you think he is."
Tessa clasped her hands in her lap. She felt a vague sense of unreality. Had things really gone so far that she needed to be warned off Will? And yet it was good to have someone to talk to about him. She felt a bit like a starving person being offered food.
I don't know what I think he is, Sophie. He's like one thing sometimes, and then he can change completely, like the wind changing, and I don't know why or what's happened.
Nothing's happened. He just doesn't care about anyone but himself.
He cares about Jem, Tessa said quietly.
The brush went still. Sophie had paused, frozen. There was something she wanted to say, Tessa thought, something she was holding herself back from saying. But what was it?
The brush began to move again. That's not enough, though.
You mean that I shouldn't wring my heart out over some boy who will never care for me?
No, Sophie said. There are worse things than that. It's all right to love someone who doesn't love you back, as long as they're worth you loving them, as long as they deserve it.
The passion in Sophie's voice surprised Tessa. She twisted around to look at the other girl.
Sophie, is there someone you care for?
Is it Thomas?
Sophie looked astonished.
Thomas? No. Whatever gave you that idea?
Well, because I think he cares for you, Tessa said. I've seen him looking at you. He watches you when you're in the room. I suppose I thought...
Her voice trailed off at Sophie's flabbergasted look.
Thomas? Sophie said again. No, that couldn't be. I'm sure he hasn't any such thoughts about me.
Tessa didn't move to contradict her. Clearly, whatever feelings Thomas might have had, Sophie didn't return them.
Which left?
Will? Tessa said. Do you mean you cared for Will once?
Which would explain the bitterness and the dislike, she thought, considering how Will treated girls who fancied him.
Will? Sophie sounded absolutely horrified, horrified enough to forget to call Will Mr. Herondale. Are you asking me if I was ever in love with him?
Well, I thought... I mean, he's awfully handsome. Tessa realized she sounded rather feeble.
There's more to someone being lovable than the way they look.
My last employer, Sophie said, her careful accent slipping with her excitement as she spoke. He was always off on safari in Africa and India shooting tigers and such. And he told me that the way you can tell if a bug or a snake is poisonous-like is if it's got really lovely bright markings. The more beautiful its skin is, the more deadly it is. That's what Will's like. All that pretty face and whatnot just hides how twisted up and rotten he is on the inside.
Sophie, I don't know.
There's something dark in him, Sophie said. Something black and dark that he's hiding. He's got some sort of secret, the kind that eats you up inside.
She set the silver-haired brush down on the vanity, and Tessa saw with surprise that her hand was shaking.
You mark my words.
After Sophie left, Tessa took the clockwork angel from her bedside table and strung it round her neck. As it settled against her chest, she felt immediately reassured. She had missed it while she'd been disguised as Camille. Its presence was a comfort, and, though it was foolish, she knew. She thought perhaps that if she visited Nate while wearing it, he might feel its presence and be reassured as well. She kept her hand on it as she shut the bedroom door behind her, made her way down the corridor, and knocked on his door softly. When there was no answer, she took hold of the knob and pushed the door open. The curtains in the room were drawn back, the room half filled with light, and she could see Nate asleep on his back against a mound of pillows. He had one arm flung across his forehead, and his cheeks were bright with fever. He wasn't alone, either. In the armchair by the head of the bed sat Jessamine, a book open on her lap. She met Tessa's surprised look with a cool and level stare. Tessa began and collected herself.
What are you doing here?
I thought I would read to your brother for a while, Jessamine said. Everyone's been asleep half the day, and he was being cruelly neglected. Just Sophie checking in on him, and you can't count on her for decent conversation.
Nate's unconscious, Jessamine. He doesn't want conversation.
You can't be sure, Jessamine said. I've heard that people can hear what you say to them even if they're quite unconscious or even dead.
He's not dead, either.
Certainly not. Jessamine gave him a lingering look. He's far too handsome to die. Is he married, Tessa? Or is there a girl back in New York who has a claim on him?
On Nate? Tessa stared. There had always been girls, all sorts of girls, who'd been interested in Nate, but he had the attention span of a butterfly.
Jessamine, he isn't even conscious. Now is hardly the time.
He'll get better, Jessamine announced.
And when he does, he'll know I'm the one who nursed him back to health. Men always fall in love with the woman who nurses them back to health. When pain and anguish wring the brow, a ministering angel thou, she finished with a self-satisfied smirk.
Seeing Tessa's horrified look, she scowled.
What's wrong? Am I not good enough for your precious brother?
He doesn't have any money, Jessie.
I have enough money for both of us. I just need someone to take me away from this place. I told you that.
In fact, you asked me if I'd be the one to do it.
Is that what's putting you out of countenance? Jessamine asked. Really, Tessa, we can still be the best of friends once we're sisters-in-law, but a man is always better than a woman for this sort of thing, don't you think?
Tessa could think of nothing to say in reply.
Jessamine shrugged. Charlotte wishes to see you, by the way, in the drawing room. She wanted me to tell you.
You don't need to worry about Nathaniel. I've been checking his temperature every quarter hour and putting cold compresses on his forehead besides.
Tessa wasn't sure she believed any of this, but as Jessamine was patently uninterested in giving up her place by Nathaniel's side, and it hardly seemed worth the battle, she turned with a disgusted sigh and left the room. The door to the drawing room, when she reached it, was slightly ajar. She could hear raised voices from the other side. She hesitated, her hand half-lifted to knock. Then she heard the sound of her own name, and she froze.
"This isn't the London hospital. Tessa's brother shouldn't be here."
It was Will's voice, raised to a shout.
"He's not a downworlder, just a stupid venal mundane who found himself mixed up in something he couldn't manage."
Charlotte replied, "He can't be treated by mundane doctors, not for what's wrong with him. Be reasonable, Will."
"He already knows about Downworld."
The voice was Jem's, calm, logical.
"In fact, he may know quite a bit of important information that we don't know. Mortmain claimed Nathaniel was working for De Quincey. He might have information about De Quincey's plans, the automatons, the whole magister business, all of it. De Quincey wanted him dead, after all. Perhaps it was because he knew something he shouldn't."
There was a long silence, then.
"We can call in the Silent Brothers again, then," said Will. "They can claw through his mind, see what they find. We needn't wait for him to wake up."
"You know, that sort of process is delicate with mundanes," protested Charlotte. "Brother Enoch has already said that the fever has driven Mr. Gray into hallucinations. It's impossible for him to sort through what in the boy's mind is the truth and what is feverish delirium. Not without damaging his mind, possibly permanently."
"I doubt it was that much of a mind to begin with."
Tessa heard Will's tone of disgust even through the door and felt her stomach tighten with rage.
"You know nothing about the man."
Jem spoke more coldly than Tessa had ever heard him speak before. "I can't imagine what's driving this mood of yours, Will, but it does you no credit."
"I know what it is," Charlotte said.
"You do?" Will sounded appalled.
"You're as upset as I am about how last night went. We had only two fatalities, true, but De Quincey's escape doesn't reflect well on us.
It was my plan. I pushed it on the Enclave, and now they will blame me for anything that went wrong. Not to mention that Camille has had to go into hiding since we've no idea where De Quincey is, and by now he probably has a blood price on her head. And Magnus Bane, of course, is furious with us that Camille has vanished. So our best informant and our best warlock are lost to us at the moment.
But we did stop De Quincey from murdering Tessa's brother, and who knows how many more mundanes," Jem said.
"That should count for something. Benedict Lightwood didn't want to believe in De Quincey's betrayal at first, Now he has no choice. He knows you were right.
That, said Charlotte, is likely only going to make him angrier.
Perhaps, said Will. And perhaps if you hadn't insisted on tying the success of my plan to the functionality of one of Henry's ridiculous inventions, we wouldn't be having this conversation now. You can dance around it all you like, but the reason everything went wrong last night is because the phosphor didn't work. Nothing Henry invents ever works. If you'd just admit your husband's a useless fool, we'd all be a lot better off.
Will, Jem's voice held cold fury.
No, James, don't.
Charlotte's voice shook. There was a sort of thump, as if she'd sat herself down very suddenly in a chair.
Will, she said, Henry is a good, kind man, and he loves you.
Don't be maudlin, Charlotte.
Will's voice held only scorn.
He's known you since you were a boy. He cares for you like you were his own younger brother.
As do I.
All I've ever done is love you, Will.
Yes, said Will, and I wish you wouldn't.
Charlotte made a pained noise like a kicked puppy.
I know you don't mean that.
I mean everything I say, said Will. Especially when I tell you that we're better off sifting through Nathaniel Gray's mind now rather than later. If you're too sentimental to do it.
Charlotte began to interrupt, but it didn't matter. This was too much for Tessa. She hurled the door open and stalked inside. The inside of the room was lit by a roaring fire, in contrast to the squares of dark gray glass that let in what there was of the cloudy twilight. Charlotte sat behind the large desk, Jem in a chair beside her. Will, on the other hand, was leaning against the fireplace mantel. He was flushed with obvious anger, his eyes blazing, his shirt collar askew. His eyes met Tessa's for a moment of pure astonishment. Any hope she had entertained that he might have magically forgotten what had happened in the attic the night before vanished. He flushed at the sight of her, his fathomless blue eyes darkening, and looked away, as if he couldn't stand to hold her gaze.
"I suppose you've been eavesdropping, then?"
he asked.
"And now you're here to give me a piece of your mind about your precious brother."
At least I have a mind to give you a piece of, which Nathaniel won't if you have your way.
Tessa turned to Charlotte.
I won't let Brother Enoch go pawing through Nate's mind. He's sick enough already, it would probably kill him.
Charlotte shook her head. She looked exhausted, her face gray, her eyelids drooping. Tessa wondered if she'd slept at all.
Most assuredly we will allow him to heal before we think about questioning him.
What if he's ill for weeks or months?
Will said.
We might not have that much time.
Why not? What's so urgent you want to risk my brother's life on it? Tessa snapped.
Will's eyes were slivers of blue glass.
All you've ever cared about is finding your brother, and now you've found him. Good for you. But that was never our goal. You do realize that, don't you? We don't usually go quite this far out of our way for the sake of one delinquent mundane.
What Will is trying to say, Jem interjected, though failing at civility, is... He broke off and sighed.
De Quincey said that your brother was someone he had trusted, and now De Quincey is gone and we have no idea where he's hiding. The notes we found in his office hint that De Quincey believed there would soon be a war between Downworlders and Shadow Hunters. A war those clockwork creatures he was working on doubtless figured into prominently. You can see why we want to know where he is and what else your brother might know.
Maybe you want to know those things, Tessa said. But it's not my fight. I'm not a shadow hunter.
Indeed, said Will. Don't think we don't know that.
Be quiet, Will.
Charlotte's tone held more than its usual asperity. She turned from him to Tessa, her brown eyes beseeching.
We trust you, Tessa. You need to trust us, too.
No, Tessa said. No, I don't. She could feel Will's gaze on her and was suddenly filled with a startling rage.
How dare he be cold to her, angry at her? What had she done to deserve it?
She'd let him kiss her, that was all.
Somehow, it was as if that alone had erased everything else she had done that evening. As if now that she'd kissed Will, it no longer mattered that she'd also been brave. You wanted to use me, just like the Dark Sisters did, and the moment you had a chance to, the moment Lady Belcourt came along and you needed what I could do, you wanted me to do it, never mind how dangerous it was. You behave as if I have some responsibility to your world, your laws and your accords. But it's your world, and you're the ones meant to govern it. It's not my fault if you're doing a rotten job.
Tessa saw Charlotte whiten and sit back. She felt a sharp twinge in her chest. It wasn't Charlotte she had meant to hurt. Still, she went on. She couldn't help herself, the words coming out in a flood.
All your talk about downworlders and how you don't hate them, that's all nothing, isn't it? Just words. You don't mean them. And as for mundanes, have you ever thought maybe you'd be better at protecting them if you didn't despise them all so much?
She looked at Will. He was pale, his eyes blazing. He looked. She wasn't sure she could describe his expression. Horrified, she thought, but not at her. The horror ran deeper than that.
Tessa, Charlotte protested, but Tessa was already fumbling for the door. She turned at the last moment on the threshold to see them all staring at her.
"Stay away from my brother," she snapped.
"And don't follow me."
Anger, Tessa thought, was satisfying in its own way when you gave in to it. There was something peculiarly gratifying about shouting in a blind rage until your words ran out. Of course, the aftermath was less pleasant. Once you told everyone you hated them and not to come after you, where exactly did you go? If she went back to her own room, it was as much as saying she was just having a tantrum that would wear off. She couldn't go to Nate and bring her black mood into his sick room, and lurking anywhere else meant risking being found sulking by Sophie or Agatha. In the end, she took the narrow winding stairs that led down through the Institute. She made her way through the witch-lit nave, and came out onto the broad front steps of the church, where she sank down on the top stair and wrapped her arms around herself, shivering in the unexpectedly cold breeze. It must have rained sometime during the day, for the steps were damp and the black stone of the courtyard shone like a mirror. The moon was out, darting in between racing scuds of cloud, and the huge iron gate gleamed blackly in the fitful light. "We are dust and shadows." "I know what you're thinking." The voice that came from the doorway behind Tessa was soft enough that it could almost have been part of the wind that rattled the leaves on the tree branches. Tessa turned. Jem stood in the arch of the doorway, the white witch light behind him lighting his hair so that it shone like metal. His face, though, was hidden in shadow. He held his cane in his right hand. The dragon's eyes gleamed watchfully at Tessa. "I don't think you do. You're thinking, if they call this damp nastiness summer, what must winter be like?"
"You'd be surprised. Winter's actually much the same."
He moved away from the door and sat down on the step beside Tessa, though not too close. "It's spring that's really lovely."
"Is it?" Tessa said, without much real interest.
"No, it's actually quite foggy and wet as well."
He looked sideways at her.
"I know you said not to follow you, but I was rather hoping you just meant Will."
"I did." Tessa twisted round to look up at him. "I shouldn't have shouted like that."
"No, you were quite right to say what you did," said Jem. "We shadow hunters have been what we are for so long, and are so insular, that we often forget to look at any situation from someone else's point of view. It is only ever about whether something is good for the Nephilim or bad for the Nephilim. Sometimes I think we forget to ask whether it is good or bad for the world."
"I never meant to hurt Charlotte."
"Charlotte is very sensitive about the way the Institute is run. As a woman, she must fight to be heard, and even then her decisions are second-guessed. You heard Benedict Lightwood at the Enclave meeting. She feels she has no freedom to make a mistake."
"Do any of us? Do any of you? Everything is life and death to you."
Tessa took a long breath of the foggy air.
It tasted of city, metal and ashes and horses and river water. I feel sometimes as if I can't bear it. Any of it. I wish I'd never learned what I was. I wish Nate had stayed home and none of this had ever happened. Sometimes, Jem said, our lives can change so fast that the change outpaces our minds and hearts. It's those times, I think, when our lives have altered, but we still long for the time before everything was altered. That is when we feel the greatest pain. I can tell you, though, from experience, you grow accustomed to it. You learn to live your new life, and you can't imagine or even really remember how things were before. You're saying I'll get used to being a warlock or whatever it is I am. You've always been what you are. That's not new. What you'll get used to is knowing it. Tessa took a deep breath and let it out slowly. I didn't mean what I said upstairs, she said. I don't think the Nephilim are as dreadful as all that. I know you didn't mean it. If you had, you wouldn't be here. You'd be at your brother's side, guarding him against our dire intentions. Will didn't really mean what he said either, did he? Tessa said after a moment. He wouldn't hurt Nate. Ah. Jem looked out toward the gate, his gray eyes thoughtful. You're correct, but I'm surprised you know it. I know it. But I've had years to understand Will, to know when he means what he says and when he doesn't. So you don't ever get angry at him? Jem laughed out loud. I would hardly say that. Sometimes I want to strangle him. How on earth do you prevent yourself? I go to my favorite place in London, said Jem, and I stand and look at the water, and I think about the continuity of life and how the river rolls on oblivious of the petty upsets in our lives. Tessa was fascinated. Does that work? Not really. But after that, I think about how I could kill him while he slept if I really wanted to, and then I feel better. Tessa giggled. So where is it, then, this favorite place of yours? For a moment, Jem looked pensive. Then he bounded to his feet and held out the hand that did not clasp the cane. Come along and I'll show you. Is it far? Not at all. He smiled. He had a lovely smile, Tessa thought. And a contagious one. She couldn't help smiling back, for what felt like the first time in ages. Tessa let herself be pulled to her feet. Jem's hand was warm and strong, surprisingly reassuring. She glanced back at the Institute once, hesitated, and let him draw her through the iron gate and out into the shadows of the city. 14. Blackfriars Bridge. 20 bridges from tower to quay wanted to know what the river knew, for they were young and the Thames was old, and this is the tale that the river told. Rudyard Kipling, The River's Tale. Stepping through the Institute's iron gate, Tessa felt a bit like Sleeping Beauty leaving her castle behind its wall of thorns. The Institute was in the center of a square, and streets left the square in each cardinal direction, plunging into narrow labyrinths between houses. Still with his hand courteously on her elbow, Jem led Tessa down a narrow passage. The sky overhead was like steel. The ground was still damp from the rain earlier in the day, and the sides of the buildings that seemed to press in on either side were streaked with damp and stained with black residues of dust. Jem talked as they went, not saying much of import, but keeping up a soothing chatter, telling her what he had thought of London when he had first come here, how everything had seemed to him a uniform shade of gray, even the people. He had been unable to believe it could rain so much in one place, and so unceasingly. The damp had seemed to come up from the floors and into his bones, so that he thought he would eventually sprout mold in the manner of a tree. You do get used to it, he said as they came out from the narrow passage and into the broadness of Fleet Street, even if sometimes you feel as if you ought to be able to be wrung out like a wash rag. Remembering the chaos of the street during the day, Tessa was comforted to see how much quieter it was in the evening, the thronging crowds reduced to the occasional figure striding along the pavement, head down, keeping to the shadows. There were still carriages and even single riders in the road, though none seemed to notice Tessa and Jem. A glamour at work? Tessa wondered, but didn't ask. She was enjoying just listening to Jem talk. This was the oldest part of the city, he told her, where London had been born. The shops that lined the street were closed, their blinds drawn, but advertisements still blared from every surface. Advertisements for everything from Pears soap to hair tonic to announcements urging people to attend a lecture on spiritualism. As Tessa walked, she caught glimpses of the spires of the Institute between the buildings and couldn't help but wonder if anyone else could see them. She remembered the parrot woman with the green skin and feathers. Was the Institute really hidden in plain sight? Curiosity getting the better of her, she asked Jem as much. "Let me show you something," he said. "Stop here." He took Tessa by the elbow and turned her so that she was facing across the street. He pointed. "What do you see there?" She squinted across the street. They were near the intersection of Fleet Street and Chancery Lane. There seemed nothing remarkable about where they stood. "The front of a bank? What else is there to see?" "Now let your mind wander a bit," he said, still in the same soft voice. "Look at something else, the way you might avoid looking directly at a cat so as not to frighten it. Glance at the bank again out of the corner of your eye. Now look at it directly and very fast." Tessa did as directed and stared. The bank was gone. In its place was a half-timbered tavern with great diamond-paned windows. The light within the windows was tinted with a reddish glow, and through the open front door more red light poured out onto the pavement. Through the glass dark shadows moved, not the familiar shadows of men and women, but shapes too tall and thin, too oddly elongated or many-limbed to be human. Bursts of laughter interrupted a high, sweet, thin music, haunting and seductive. A sign hanging over the door showed a man reaching to tweak the nose of a horned demon. Lettered below the image were the words, "The Devil Tavern." "This is where Will was the other night." Tessa looked toward Jem. He was staring at the tavern, his hand light on her arm, his breathing slow and soft. She could see the red light at the pub reflected in his silvery eyes like sunset on water. "Is this your favorite place?" she asked. The intensity went out of his gaze. He looked at her and laughed. "Lord, no," he said. "Just something I wanted you to see." Someone came out of the tavern door then. A man in a long black overcoat, an elegant watered silk hat placed firmly on his head. As he glanced up the street, Tessa saw that his skin was an inky dark blue, his hair and beard as white as ice. He moved east toward the Strand as Tessa watched, wondering if he would garner curious stares. But his passage was no more noted by passers-by than that of a ghost would be. In fact, the mundanes who passed in front of the Devil Tavern seemed barely to notice it at all, even when several spindly, chittering figures exited and nearly knocked over a tired-looking man wheeling an empty cart. He paused to look around for a moment, puzzled, then shrugged and went on. "There was a very ordinary tavern there once," said Jem. "As it grew more and more infested with downworlders, the Nephilim became concerned about the intertwining of the shadow world with the mundane world. They barred mundanes from the place by the simple expedient of using a glamour to convince them that the tavern had been knocked down and a bank erected in its place. The devil is a nearly exclusively downworlder haunt now." Jem glanced up at the moon, a frown crossing his face. "It's growing late. We'd better move on." After a single glance back at the devil, Tessa moved after Jem, who continued to chat easily as they went, pointing out things of interest. The temple church where the law courts were now and where once the Knights Templar had sustained pilgrims on their route to the Holy Land. They were friends of the Nephilim, the Knights. Mundanes, but not without their own knowledge of the Shadow World. And of course, he added as they came out from the network of streets and onto Blackfriars Bridge itself, many think that the Silent Brothers are the original Blackfriars, though no one can prove it. This is it, he added, gesturing before him. My favorite place in London. Looking out over the bridge, Tessa couldn't help but wonder what Jem liked so much about the place. It stretched from one bank of the Thames to the other, a low granite bridge with multiple arches, the parapets painted dark red and gilded with gold and scarlet paint that gleamed in the moonlight. It would have been pretty if it hadn't been for the railway bridge that ran along the east side of it, silent in the shadows but still an ugly latticework of iron railing stretching away to the river's opposite bank. I know what you're thinking, Jem said again, just as he had outside the Institute. The railway bridge, it's hideous. But it means people rarely come here to admire the view. I enjoy the solitude and just the look of the river, silent under the moon. They walked to the center of the bridge, where Tessa leaned against a granite parapet and looked down. The Thames was black in the moonlight. The expanse of London stretched away on either bank, the great dome of St. Paul's looming up behind them like a white ghost, and everything shrouded in the softening fog that laid a gently blurring veil over the harsh lines of the city. Tessa glanced down at the river. The smell of salt and dirt and rot came off the water, mixing with the fog. Still, there was something portentous about London's river, as if it carried the weight of the past in its currents. A bit of old poetry came into her head. "Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song," she said, half under her breath. Normally she would never have quoted poetry aloud in front of anyone, but there was something about Jem that made her feel that whatever she did, he wouldn't pass judgment on her. "I've heard that bit of rhyme before," was all he said. "Wills quoted it at me. What is it?" "Spenser. Prothalamian." Tessa frowned. Will does seem to have an odd affinity for poetry, for someone so...
Will reads constantly and has an excellent memory, said Jem. There is very little he does not remember.
There was something in his voice that lent weight to his assertion beyond the mere statement of fact.
You like Will, don't you? Said Tessa. I mean, you're fond of him.
I love him as if he were my brother, said Jem matter-of-factly.
You can say that, Tessa said.
However horrid he is to everyone else, he loves you. He's kind to you. What did you ever do to make him treat you so differently from all the rest? Jem leaned sideways against the parapet, his gaze on her, but still far away. He tapped his fingers thoughtfully against the jade top of his cane. Taking advantage of his clear distraction, Tessa let herself stare at him, marveling a little at his strange beauty in the moonlight. He was all silver and ashes, not like Will's strong colors of blue and black and gold. Finally, he said, I don't know, really. I used to think it was because we were both without parents, and therefore he felt we were the same. I'm an orphan, Tessa pointed out. So is Jessamine. He doesn't think he is like us.
No, he doesn't.
Jem's eyes were guarded as if there were something he wasn't saying. I don't understand him, Tessa said. He can be kind one moment and absolutely awful the next. I cannot decide if he is kind or cruel, loving or hateful. Does it matter? Jem said. Is it required that you make such a decision? The other night, she went on, in your room when Will came in, he said he'd been drinking all night, but then later when you... Later he seemed to become instantly sober. I've seen my brother drunk. I know it doesn't vanish like that in an instant. Even my aunt throwing a pail of cold water in Nate's face wouldn't have roused him from stupor, not if he were truly intoxicated. And Will didn't smell of alcohol or seem ill the next morning.
But why would he lie and say he was drunk if he wasn't?
Jem looked resigned. And there you have the essential mystery of Will Herondale. I used to wonder the same thing myself. How anyone could drink as much as he claimed and survive, much less fight as well as he does. So one night I followed him.
You followed him?
Jem grinned crookedly.
Yes.
He went out, claiming an assignation or some such, and I followed him. If I'd known what to expect, I would have worn sturdier shoes. All night he walked through the city, from St. Paul's to Spitalfields Market to Whitechapel High Street. He went down to the river and wandered about the docks. Never did he stop to speak to a single soul. It was like following a ghost. The next morning he was ready with some ribald tale of false adventures, and I never demanded the truth. If he wishes to lie to me, then he must have a reason.
He lies to you, and yet you trust him?
Yes, Jem said. I trust him.
But he lies consistently.
He always invents the story that will make him look the worst.
Then has he told you what happened to his parents?
Either the truth or lies?
Not entirely.
Bits and pieces, Jem said after a long pause. I know that his father left the Nephilim before Will was ever born. He fell in love with a mundane girl, and when the council refused to make her a shadow hunter, he left the clave and moved with her to a very remote part of Wales where they thought they wouldn't be interfered with. The clave was furious.
Will's mother was a mundane? You mean he is only half a shadow hunter?
Nephilim blood is dominant, said Jem. That's why there are three rules for those who leave the clave. First, you must sever contact with any and all shadow hunters you've ever known, even your own family. They can never speak to you again, nor can you speak to them. Second, you cannot call upon the clave for help, no matter what your danger. And the third...
What's the third?
Even should you leave the clave, said Jem, they can still lay claim to your children. A little shiver went through Tessa. Jem was still staring out at the river, as if he could see Will in its silvered surface. Every 6 years, he said, until the child is 18, a representative of the clave comes to your family and asks the child if they would like to leave their family and join the Nephilim.
I can't imagine anyone would, Tessa said, appalled.
I mean, you'd never be able to speak to your family again, would you?
Jem shook his head.
And Will agreed to that? He joined the Shadow Hunters regardless?
He refused. Twice he refused.
Then one day, Will was 12 or so, there was a knock on the Institute door and Charlotte answered it. She would have been 18 then, I think. Will was standing there on the steps. She told me he was covered in road dust and dirt as if he'd been sleeping in hedgerows. He said, I am a shadow hunter, one of you. You have to let me in. I have nowhere else to go.
He said that? Will? I have nowhere else to go?
Jem hesitated. You understand all this information I heard from Charlotte. Will's never mentioned a word of any of it to me. But that's what she claims, he said.
I don't understand. His parents... They're dead, aren't they? Or they would have come looking for him.
They did, Jem said quietly. A few weeks after Will arrived, Charlotte told me, his parents followed. They came to the front door of the Institute and banged on it, calling for him. Charlotte went into Will's room to ask him if he wanted to see them. He had crawled under the bed and had his hands over his ears. He wouldn't come out no matter what she did, and he wouldn't see them. I think Charlotte finally went down and sent them away, or they left of their own accord, I'm not sure.
Sent them away? But their child was inside the Institute. They had a right.
They had no right. Jem spoke gently enough, Tessa thought, but there was something in his tone that put him as far away from her as the moon. Will chose to join the Shadow Hunters. Once he made that choice, they had no more claim on him. It was the right and responsibility of the clave to turn them away.
And you've never asked him why?
If he wanted me to know, he'd tell me, Jem said.
You asked why I think he tolerates me better than other people. I'd imagine it's precisely because I've never asked him why. He smiled at her wryly.
The cold air had whipped color into his cheeks and his eyes were bright. Their hands were close to each other's on the parapet. For a brief, half-confused moment, Tessa thought that he might be about to put his hand over hers, but his gaze slid past her and he frowned.
Bit late for a walk, isn't it?
Following his gaze, she saw the shadowy figures of a man and woman coming toward them across the bridge. The man wore a workman's felt hat and a dark woolen coat. The woman had her hand on his arm, her face inclined toward his.
They probably think the same about us, Tessa said.
She looked up into Jem's eyes. And you? Did you come to the Institute because you had nowhere else to go? Why didn't you stay in Shanghai?
My parents ran the Institute there, said Jem, but they were murdered by a demon.
It was called Yan Luo. His voice was very calm. After they died, everyone thought that the safest thing for me would be to leave the country, in case the demon or its cohorts came after me as well.
But why here? Why England?
My father was British. I spoke English. It seemed reasonable. Jem's tone was as calm as ever, but Tessa sensed there was something he wasn't telling her. I thought I would feel more at home here than I would in Idris, where neither of my parents had ever been. Across the bridge from them, the strolling couple had paused at a parapet. The man seemed to be pointing out features of the railway bridge, the woman nodding as he spoke.
And did you feel more at home, that is?
Not precisely, Jem said. Almost the first thing I realized when I came here was that my father never thought of himself as British, not the way an Englishman would. Real Englishmen are British first and gentlemen second. Whatever else it is they might be, a doctor, a magistrate, or landowner, comes third. For shadow hunters it's different. We are Nephilim, first and foremost. And only after that do we make a nod to whatever country we might have been born and bred in. And as for third, there is no third. We are only ever shadow hunters. When other Nephilim look at me, they see only a shadow hunter. Not like mundanes, who look at me and see a boy who is not entirely foreign, but not quite like them either.
Half one thing and half another, Tessa said.
Like me, but you know you're human. Jem's expression softened.
As are you, in all the ways that matter.
Tessa felt the backs of her eyes sting. She glanced up and saw that the moon had passed behind a cloud, giving it a pearlescent luster.
I suppose we should go back. The others must be worried.
Jem moved to offer her his arm, and paused. The strolling couple Jem had noted before were suddenly in front of them, blocking their way. Though they must have moved very swiftly to reach the far side of the bridge so fast, they stood eerily still now, their arms linked. The woman's face was concealed in the shadow of a plain bonnet, the man's hidden beneath the brim of his felt hat. Jem's hand tightened on Tessa's arm, but his voice was neutral when he spoke.
"Good evening. Is there something we can help you with?"
Neither of them spoke, but they moved a step closer, the woman's skirt rustling in the wind. Tessa looked around, but there was no one else on the bridge, no one visible at either embankment. London seemed utterly deserted under the blurring moon.
"Pardon me," Jem said. "I'd appreciate it if you'd let me and my companion go by."
He took a step forward and Tessa followed. They were close enough now to the silent couple that when the moon came out from behind its cloud, flooding the bridge with silvery light and illuminating the face of the man in the felt hat, Tessa recognized him instantly. The tangled hair, the wide, once-broken nose and scarred chin, and most of all the protruding, popping eyes, the same eyes as the woman who stood beside him, her blank stare fixed on Tessa in a manner terribly reminiscent of Miranda's.
"But you're dead. Will killed you. I saw your body."
Tessa whispered, "It's him, the coachman. He belongs to the Dark Sisters." The coachman chuckled.
"I belong," he said, "to the Magister.
While the Dark Sisters served him, I served them. Now I serve him alone.
The coachman's voice sounded different from how Tessa remembered. Less thick, more articulate, with an almost sinister smoothness. Beside Tessa, Jem had gone very still. "Who are you?" he demanded. "Why are you following us?"
"The Magister has directed us to follow you," the coachman said. "You are Nephilim. You are responsible for the destruction of his home, the destruction of his people, the children of the night. We are here to deliver a declaration of war, and we are here for the girl."
He turned his eyes to Tessa.
"She is the property of the Magister, and he will have her."
"The Magister," said Jem, his eyes very silver in the moonlight. "Do you mean De Quincey?"
"The name you give him does not matter. He is the Magister. He has told us to deliver a message. That message is war."
Jem's hand tightened on the head of his cane.
"You serve De Quincey, but are not vampires. What are you?"
The woman standing beside the coachman made a strange sighing noise like the high whistle of a train.
"Beware, Nephilim. As you slay others, so shall you be slain. Your angel cannot protect you against that which neither God nor the devil has made."
Tessa began to turn toward Jem, but he was already in motion. His hand swung up the jade-headed cane in it. There was a flash. A wickedly sharp and shimmering blade shot from the end of the cane. With a swift turn of his body, Jem plunged the blade forward and slashed it into the coachman's chest. The man staggered back, a high whirring sound of surprise issuing from his throat. Tessa drew in her breath. A long slash across the coachman's shirt gaped open, and beneath it was visible neither flesh nor blood but shining metal, raggedly scored by Jem's blade. Jem drew his blade back, letting out a breath, satisfaction mixed with relief.
"I knew it."
The coachman snarled. His hand darted into his coat and withdrew a long serrated knife, the kind butchers used to cut through bone, while the woman, snapping into action, moved toward Tessa, her ungloved hands outstretched. Their movements were jerky, uneven, but very, very fast, much faster than Tessa would have guessed they could move. The coachman's companion advanced on Tessa, her face expressionless, her mouth half open. Something metallic gleamed inside it. Metal or copper.
"She has no gullet, and I would guess no stomach. Her mouth ends in a sheet of metal behind her teeth."
Tessa retreated until her back hit the parapet. She looked for Jem, but the coachman was advancing on him again. Jem slashed away at him with the blade, but it seemed only to slow the man down. The coachman's coat and shirt hung away from his body now in ragged strips, clearly showing the metal carapace beneath. The woman grabbed for Tessa, who darted aside. The woman lumbered forward and crashed into the parapet. She seemed to feel no more pain than the coachman did. She drew herself stiffly upright and turned to move toward Tessa again. The impact seemed to have damaged her left arm, though, for it hung bent at her side. She swung toward Tessa with her right arm, fingers grasping, and seized her by the wrist. Her grip was tight enough to make Tessa scream as the small bones in her wrist flared with pain. She clawed at the hand that held her, her fingers sinking deep into slick, soft skin. It peeled away like the skin of a fruit, Tessa's nail scraping against the metal beneath with a harshness that sent shivers up her spine. She tried to jerk her hand back, but she only succeeded in pulling the woman toward her. She was making a whirring, clicking noise in her throat that sounded unpleasantly insectile, and up close her eyes were pupilless and black. Tessa pulled her foot back to kick out, and there was the sudden clang of metal on metal. Jem's blade flashed down with a clean slice, cutting the woman's arm in half at the elbow. Tessa, released, fell back, the bodiless hand falling from her wrist, striking the ground at her feet. The woman was jerking around toward Jem, whir-click, whir-click. He moved forward, striking at the woman hard with the flat of the cane, knocking her back a step, and then another and another, until she hit the railing of the bridge so hard that she overbalanced. Without a cry, she fell, plunging toward the water below. Tessa raced to the railing just in time to see her slip beneath the surface. No bubbles rose to show where she had vanished. Tessa spun back around. Jem was clutching his cane, breathing hard. Blood ran down the side of his face from a cut, but he seemed otherwise unharmed. He held his weapon loosely in one hand as he gazed at a dark, humped shape on the ground at his feet, a shape that moved and jerked, flashes of metal showing between the ribbons of its torn clothing. When Tessa moved closer, she saw that it was the body of the coachman, writhing and jerking. His head had been sliced cleanly away, and a dark, oily substance pumped from the stump of his neck, staining the ground. Jem reached up to push his sweat-dampened hair back, smearing the blood across his cheek. His hand shook. Hesitantly, Tessa touched his arm. "Are you all right?" His smile was faint. "I should be asking you that." He shuddered slightly. "Those mechanical things, they unnerve me. They..." He broke off, staring past her. At the south end of the bridge, moving toward them with sharp staccato motions, were at least a half dozen more of the clockwork creatures. Despite the jerkiness of their movements, they were approaching swiftly, almost hurtling forward. They were already a third of the way across the bridge. With a sharp click, the blade vanished back into Jem's cane. He seized Tessa's hand, his voice breathless. "Run!" They ran, Tessa clutching his hand, glancing behind only once, in terror. The creatures had made it to the center of the bridge and were moving toward them, gathering speed. They were male, Tessa saw, dressed in the same kind of dark woolen coats and felt hats as the coachman had been. Their faces gleamed in the moonlight. Jem and Tessa reached the steps at the end of the bridge, and Jem kept a tight grip on Tessa's hand as they hurtled down the stairs. Her boots slipped on the damp stone, and he caught her, his cane clattering awkwardly against her back. She felt his chest rise and fall against hers, hard, as if he were gasping. But he couldn't be out of breath, could he? He was a shadow hunter. The Codex said they could run for miles. Jem pulled away, and she saw that his face was tight, as if he were in pain. She wanted to ask him if he'd been hurt, but there was no time. They could hear clattering footsteps on the stairs above them. Without a word, Jem took hold of her wrist again and pulled her after him. They passed the embankment, lit by the glow of its dolphin lamps, before Jem turned aside and plunged between two buildings into a narrow alley. The alley sloped up, away from the river. The air between the buildings was dank and close, the cobblestone slick with filth. Washing flapped like ghosts from windows overhead. Tessa's feet were screaming in their fashionable boots, her heart slamming against her chest, but there was no slowing down. She could hear the creatures behind them, hear the whir-click of their movements, closer and closer. The alley opened out into a wide street, and there, rising up before them, was the looming edifice of the Institute. They dashed through the entrance, Jem releasing her as he whirled to slam and lock the gates behind them. The creatures reached them just as the bolt slid home. They crashed against the gate like wind-up toys unable to stop themselves, rattling the iron with a tremendous crash. Tessa backed up, staring. The clockwork creatures were pressed up against the gates, their hands reaching through the gaps in the iron. She looked around wildly. Jem stood beside her. He was as white as paper, one hand pressed to his side. She reached for his hand, but he stepped back out of her reach. "Tessa," his voice was uneven, "get into the Institute. You need to get inside." "Are you hurt, Jem? Are you injured?" "No." His voice was muffled. A rattle from the gate made Tessa look up. One of the clockwork men had his hand through the gap in the gate and was pulling at the iron chain that held it closed. As she stared in fascinated horror, she saw that he was dragging at the loops of metal with such force that the skin was peeling away from his fingers, showing the jointed metal hands beneath. There was obviously tremendous strength in those hands. The metal was warping and twisting in his grip. It was clearly a matter of minutes before the chain split and broke. Tessa seized hold of Jem's arm. His skin was burning hot to the touch. She could feel it through his clothes. "Come on." With a groan, he let her pull him toward the front door of the church. He was staggering and leaning on her heavily, his breath rattling in his chest. They lurched up the stairs, Jem sliding out of her grip almost the moment they reached the top step. He hit the ground on his knees, choking coughs ripping through him, his whole